This is a Triple J podcast. Hack.
Hey, it's Dave Marchese. This is the Hack Podcast. Why doesn't Centrelink class you as independent from your parents until 22? If you've been away to study and maybe from a country area or wherever you're from, you probably know this. It's a question generations of students have been asking. It means a lot of students cannot afford to study because they don't have access to support payments and they can't afford living away from home. So do you reckon students in regional and remote areas are being discriminated against? That's what we're going to be looking into later in this podcast, hearing from some of the students who are demanding some change on this, and they're not the only ones. Also coming up, we're going to find out more about the new person picked for one of Australia's most powerful jobs. It could be the most powerful job in Australia, actually. More on that soon. First, though.
Hack. Humanitarians take risks, but at the same time, they did everything right.
On Triple J.
Oh, it's a chilling picture that you've probably seen online. A blood-spattered Australian passport in Gaza. It belonged to Zomi Frankham, an aid worker killed in an Israeli airstrike. The Israeli military says the strike was a grave mistake. It's blamed misidentification. But world leaders are condemning Israel for the deaths of Zomi and six other aid workers from around the world. And now there are real worries about what this is going to mean for the future of humanitarian support in and around Gaza. In a bit, we're going to speak to an aid worker in the region about how they're feeling. But first, here's Ariana Lachente with an update.
I'm just sad that she had decades more of this left to do.
Josh Phelps worked with Zomi Frankham. She grew up in Sydney and spent years of her life helping people cope with the worst kinds of tragedies, from bushfires in Australia to famines and wars, like the one raging in Gaza. Now she's one of its casualties, killed in an Israeli airstrike along with six of her colleagues at an aid group called World Central Kitchen.
Everybody's sad, shocked, because she was really special and she made people feel special.
Israel says it was a mistake. It's got politicians everywhere demanding an explanation.
We know that Zomi's life was a life dedicated to the service of others, and it is a tragedy what has occurred.
I expressed Australia's anger and concern at the death of Zomi Frankham. This is completely unacceptable.
Palestinians and citizens of the UK, Poland, and a dual US-Canadian national also died in the blasts. They were all workers hit after unloading food at a warehouse in central Gaza on Monday. It highlights the dangers for aid workers in the region, as Juliet Tuma from UNRWA explains.
The road that they travelled on was deconflicted with the Israeli army. They had clearly marked cars and they still got killed.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the aid workers weren't targeted.
This happens in wartime. We are thoroughly looking into it, are in contact with the governments of the foreigners among the dead, and will do everything to ensure it does not happen again.
The deaths add to the record number of aid workers killed in this conflict. Antonio Guterres is the United Nations Secretary General.
The devastating Israeli airstrikes that killed World Central Kitchen personnel bring the number of aid workers killed in this conflict to 196.
The World Central Kitchen has now suspended its delivery of aid into Gaza. Other aid groups have too. And it comes at a critical time. Nabal Farsak from the Palestinian Red Crescent Society says the situation on the ground is dire.
The entire population in Gaza suffer from very dangerous levels from food insecurity. Half of the population suffer from catastrophic hunger and famine is imminent.
Over in Gaza City, Palestinians search for bodies in the rubble of Al-Shifa Hospital and surrounding areas. Israeli forces have now left the complex after 2 weeks of fighting. Israel says it was targeting terrorists at the hospital. But the hospital's acting director has described what's left behind as a wasteland.
Most of the buildings of the Al-Shifa medical complex were completely destroyed and burned. It is no longer possible to work in Al-Shifa medical complex.
The IDF claims it killed 200 Palestinians who were militants and that 900 other suspects have been arrested. Gaza's media office, run by Hamas, says 400 Palestinians were killed around the hospital. The war in Gaza has been going since October 7 last year, when Hamas gunmen killed 1,100 people in Israel and captured hundreds of hostages. Since then, Gazan officials say the death toll from Israel's invasion is more than 32,000. And there's still no sign of a ceasefire. In Israel, pressure is building on Benjamin Netanyahu. With 100 hostages still being held in Gaza, thousands of protesters want him to go.
We have a government that has failed in its position to protect Israel, and we think that we should have elections soon and that our prime minister is not fit.
Hack on Triple J.
Arianna Lecente with that update. Want to find out now what it's like being an aid worker in and around Gaza at the moment. It can't be easy. We've been hearing from several people who knew some of those killed over the past 24 hours, hearing their disbelief and also that they're scared, that they are frightened to go to work. Let's ask one aid worker now. Bushra Khalidi is Oxfam's policy and advocacy lead based in Ramallah, a Palestinian city in the West Bank. She is with us. Bushra, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us. I'm sure you and your colleagues are pretty shaken by this news. How dangerous does it feel being a humanitarian worker right now where you are?
I mean, I'm not only a humanitarian worker, I'm also Palestinian. So we have been living in fear for the last 6 months. This really has been a reality. It's utterly unacceptable. But unfortunately, it's not an isolated event. There's been already 196 aid workers killed. And this is just the aid workers from the NGO and UN. It's not including all of the health workers that were killed. There's over 300 of them. In Gaza, I mean, the situation is just, it's impossible. The fear that I'm living in is also nothing like the fear that they're living under, with relentless bombardment over their heads the whole time. We have been saying as humanitarian organizations for the last 6 months that there's nowhere safe in Gaza. Gaza is a very, very small place. It was already one of the most densely populated areas in the world. And now there was 1.8 million people crammed into the south. And we're having to deliver to a population that is starving, to a population that is living in famine-like conditions. And while the bombs are raining over our heads, on top of that, our colleagues, they have their families. They need to feed their families. They need to find the basics for their families. So not only are they trying to do their job and showing up to work, but they're also trying to find the next meal for their kids.
Personally, as you say, as a Palestinian, but as somebody who's working on the ground every day, what is the experience like? Like, have you ever experienced anything like this before in terms of working conditions and the stress that aid workers are now under?
This is not like anything we've ever seen. Oxfam has been in the occupied Palestinian territory for over 50 years. We're very familiar with this context. We have been responding in Gaza. This is a sixth escalation in Gaza. So we're very familiar with this type of work. And of course, we fear for our lives. And even me, from a personal point of view, I'm afraid to go to my office in Jerusalem because of settler violence in the West Bank and because of how dangerous the roads can be. And so I've not left Ramallah in the last 6 months. And my office is in Jerusalem. Also, it's affected the rest of my colleagues and my team because permits have been canceled. So before, we had permits to go into Jerusalem and go to Israel. That's no longer the case since the 7th of October. And so it also impacts our operations because we can't serve the most vulnerable in the most efficient way because of roadblocks, because of checkpoints, because of settler violence on the roads, and because of permits have been canceled. And now in Gaza, it's kind of a different fear. You know, the convoy may be targeted. We may be killed. We might have, for example, we had a fruit and veg plan delivery, boxes delivery. Well, we couldn't deliver that day because it was too dangerous to deliver the fruit and veg boxes. And so all of that went to waste. And so, like, it's also having an impact on that and the cost, right? Because we're unable to deliver in the way we want to. And so, of course, this causes delays and backlogs. And then, I mean, simply the fear of losing your life while delivering aid. I mean, How absurd is this thought? And the worst part of it is that we share our locations with Israeli authorities. This is part of the protocols and the processes we have in place as a humanitarian country team operating here. We always share our locations. Not only do we share our locations of and our movement, but we also share the locations of our warehouses, office spaces. And these have been targeted in the last 6 months as well. Our own warehouse was targeted. It was an UNRWA warehouse because we use UNRWA warehouses to stock. It caused the loss of almost $1.8 million. So this is a reality that we have always faced, but now at a scale that has never been seen before.
World Central Kitchen has suspended its operations in Gaza. Are you worried about the impact this is going to have on civilians because charities will maybe think twice about providing aid?
Absolutely. I mean, listen, we have said as well as a consortium or a group of organizations, of the international organization, but also human rights organization, we've said and we have been warning that if a Rafah incursion is to happen, this will halt humanitarian operations. And now we're seeing this happen in Ramallah. You know, a Rafah operation hasn't even happened. I mean, or hasn't intensified in the way that we've imagined it to intensify because Rafah has happened in some way. So, yes, it's of course a concern, especially that we know that World Central Kitchen is, you know, delivering a lot of aid and food and has these soup kitchens that have been very effective. But again, I mean, it's, you know, the level of need is not just about food. You know, when you've reached a starvation level, you need medical treatment, you need nutrient supplements. And so the fact that, you know, we might suspend operations like or some have already done so, I mean, that is a huge concern. And Israel has to abide by its duties and obligations under international law. Israel occupies Gaza. Actually, Israel should be protecting the Palestinian civilian population, not deliberately attacking it and obstructing humanitarian aid efforts, which is it has deliberately done.
You're listening to Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Bushra Khalidi, Oxfam's policy and advocacy lead based in Ramallah, about the situation in Gaza, the West Bank at the moment, after the death of a group of aid workers. There's obviously a lot of international condemnation following those deaths. One of the aid workers killed was an Australian, and Australia's government's responded. Our Prime Minister's condemned the strike, demanded that Israel conduct a thorough, quick review. Do you think that's enough?
Statements are not enough anymore. Member states are very aware of the measures that they can take in accordance with the ICJ order that has found that there's a likelihood of a risk of genocide occurring in Gaza. And there are measures, political measures, diplomatic tools that member states can actually take to put pressure on Israel. Those do not include statements. Stop arming Israel. And so a review at this stage, what does that give when almost 15,000 of these 32,000 are children? 15,000 children have been killed. It should not take the death of one foreign aid worker for words of condemnation. We need more than that. We're at 196 humanitarian workers killed now. We need action.
Bushra, you're speaking to young Australians right now. Our audience is young people across the board. We know Gaza, the West Bank, is made up of so many young people. I imagine you're speaking to a lot of them. What are they telling you about their thoughts, their hopes for the future?
Palestinians feel abandoned by the world. Completely. And we feel like the world has double standards and comes to the safety of some and leaves the rest to their own demise. There is no hope for the future for Palestinians and Palestinian young people. I used to work for another organization a few years back after the 2021 war. We conducted an assessment of the hopes of children in Gaza for the future. Most of them said that they felt abandoned by the world. How are they feeling now? This was in 2021. What hope is there when your home has been demolished, when your parents have been killed, when you have lost a limb, when there's no schools, when there's no infrastructure around you, when everything has been decimated, and when you scream to the world for a ceasefire, nobody heeds that call? What message are we sending those children?
If you could speak to someone listening right now, maybe a young Australian who's feeling pretty helpless at the moment, that they feel like they are very upset by what they're hearing but don't have the power to do anything about it, what would you say to them?
I don't think so. I think there's so much power in the collective. And I think that that has shown. We had some, you know, countries that wouldn't utter the word ceasefire. It was considered political or taking sides. And now those countries are, you know, calling for ceasefire. It's much too late. But this is because of public pressure. And this is because people have not stopped speaking out and holding their representatives accountable. And it should not stop. And we should not be discouraged, because then we actually then completely kill any hope for Gaza. They are enduring these atrocities. The minimum for us is to speak out on their behalf, amplify their voices.
We appreciate you speaking with us today. Thank you very much for your time, Bushra Khalidi from Oxfam. Thanks for coming on Hack and speaking to all of us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hack on Triple J.
And if you do want the latest on what is happening in Gaza, of course, ABC News is the place to go. You can find the latest updates there online all the time.
Hack.
Ms. Mostyn will be the 28th Governor General of the Commonwealth of Australia.
On Triple J.
Yeah, you might have seen some big news today about Australia getting a new Governor General. Her name is Samantha Mostyn, a businesswoman, former lawyer, also the only second woman to hold one of the highest offices of the country. So what is the Governor-General? What does all this mean? Why should you care? Well, political reporter Shalala Medora is here to break it all down. Hey, Shalala, thanks for coming on.
Hello, Dave. Nice to speak to you.
Yeah, I don't think you could blame anyone for being a bit confused about who the Governor-General is and what they do, because they're not always in the news. It's probably a title, a position people hear about but might not know a whole lot about. Why is the Governor-General important?
Yeah, so look, the Governor-General is the King's representative. Australia is a constitutional monarchy, which means our King or Queen, at the moment it's the King, is our highest office holder. But, you know, they're all the way over there in Britain at the moment. They don't get to see the day-to-day. So they have a representative here in Australia who has a few certain powers for them. Broadly speaking, they have kind of three roles. They have a constitutional role. So this is like designated in the Constitution about what they do. They do things like set parliamentary sittings, they sign off on laws, it's called royal assent, and they're also the commander-in-chief of Australia's armed forces. They also have ceremonial roles, so they do things like swearing in ministers and prime ministers and administering things like the Australian of the Year awards, for example. And broadly speaking, they also have a civil role, so they do things like visit natural disaster zones and speak to victims. They might attend the opening of national memorials, things that kind of signal that they are there for members of the community.
Okay, Shalala, so who decides who becomes the Governor-General? Because they're not elected like politicians.
They aren't. In fact, it's really basically up to the Prime Minister of the day as to who becomes the Governor-General. They don't need to go to the opposition. They don't need to get it cleared by the opposition leader, even though the opposition leader is the alternative Prime Minister. They don't even need to get it through Parliament. It's essentially a captain's pick.
It's so interesting that that's how easy it is. I mean, I imagine there's a bit more goes into
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I mean,
that.
They have to also kind of go to the King. Oh, we think this person's a good person for this job.
Right.
And the King goes, if you say so, I'll sign off on it.
So this new Governor-General, Samantha Mostyn, what do we know about her? Because she seems a little bit different to some of the others that we've had in the past.
Yeah, Samantha Mostyn is really interesting. First of all, she's only our second ever woman Governor-General after Quentin Bryce, whose term ended in 2014. She's also the first ever business person we've had in this role. Mm. Traditionally, the Governor-General comes from the military, them being the commander-in-chief of our armed forces, or the church, or the judiciary. That's been where the lion's share of Governor-Generals have come from. Samantha Mostyn herself is a really strong gender equality advocate. The Prime Minister said she represents a modern leader for a modern nation. She's worked in a whole range of different roles, including in Reconciliation Australia, the Climate Council, the Foundation for Young Australians. She was an AFL commissioner, the first female to hold that role. But she said in a press conference this morning that what she was really passionate about was working for the community.
Millions of Australians know this to be true, that being of service is what often provides a person with their greatest happiness and sense of purpose. That is certainly the case for me, and I can think of no greater purpose, Prime Minister, than to serve this country I love as Governor General.
So, Shalala, what does all this mean for the Republican movement in Australia? People might be wondering about that, where it's up to.
Yeah, so people who support a republic would have probably had a bit of a bounce in their step when the new Anthony Albanese government appointed an assistant minister for the republic. It was the first time we've ever had a role like that. But it's kind of been cricket since then, because to become a republic, we'd need to change the constitution. And to change the constitution, we'd need to have a referendum. And you might remember we had one of those recently, the Voice to Parliament referendum, and it didn't go the government's way. So they're pretty reluctant to wade into a debate on something as contentious as a republic that soon after yet another contentious referendum.
Okay, so it's something that might appear later on, but who knows? Look, we know that you'll be across it if it does pop up. Hack political reporter Shalala Medora, thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks so much, Dave.
Hack. We aren't able to classify you as independent, but I don't even live with my parents.
On Triple J.
Oh, what do you think of when I say youth allowance? Endless forms, headaches, confusion, pretty common feelings, I'd imagine. It is a bit of a ritual, isn't it, trying to get some support? Especially if you're heading off to study, you've got to travel a long way. It's especially hard for young people from the country, from regional areas. Launceston reporter Louise Myland's been looking into why.
It's an exciting time for any teenager from the country. You've turned 18, you're off to the city to study, and you're looking for a place to rent. Oh, and you'll probably need a job or two to cover that.
I was working as a sports mascot, I was working as a teacher's aide, as a tutor, I was working at one point as a debating adjudicator. I've been working for the uni for a little while as well.
That's Jack Oates-Pryor. He's a 20-year-old student from Launceston who made the move to Hobart on his own, working five jobs to support his new independence. But Jack isn't eligible for youth allowance.
I think that I'm really disappointed in the system, that it traps students like myself out of financial support.
So what's going on? Well, if you've been in this position yourself, you already know the answer. Basically, if you're younger than 22 and you haven't worked 30 hours a week for 18 months, you're considered dependent on your parents by default, regardless of whether they're actually funding your study. In Jack's case, because his folks' income is over the threshold, he doesn't get a cent.
This current system does disproportionately disadvantage students in remote and regional areas.
These rules have been in place for a long time. But a few weeks ago, a big review of the uni system called the Universities Accord recommended raising the parental income test limit to help more country students access youth allowance and fund their uni or TAFE.
There's a real inequity between city students and rural and regional or remote students in accessing tertiary education.
Fiona Nash is the Regional Education Commissioner who worked on the review.
We know it's around $30,000 a year for those regional families to support their students, the cost of actually them having to leave home because they have no choice to attend university. So I think it's something that the government should look at very, very closely.
I got in touch with Social Services Minister Amanda Rishworth about this. In a statement, she told me the age of independence was set at 22 because the system was based on the principle that financial support for students is a shared responsibility between parents, guardians, the government, and students themselves. She also pointed to a special Commonwealth scholarship scheme and things like fares allowance and tertiary access payments, which she points out are also options for regional students. But there's a catch with one of those things. To get the relocation scholarship, students must already be receiving AB study or youth allowance. So for someone like Jack, it's not that much use.
It certainly can be really stressful, needing to try and organise my schedule on a day-to-day basis. You know, am I able to work today or do I need to go to these lectures? For a lot of students that I know, then it's really overwhelming.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J.
Louise Myland reporting there from Launceston, production there by Angus McIntosh. Want to get into this a bit more now with Isabella Coombs from ANU's Regional Rural Remote Students Association. I reckon she's got a bit to say. G'day, Isabella. Thanks for coming on Hack.
Thanks for having me.
How big of an issue is welfare support for regional students? I mean, I imagine you're speaking to a lot of students from the country at your uni. Is this something that's always coming up?
Yeah, I mean, it's massive because a lot of us have to, especially at ANU, students are relocating. It's a question of, am I going to be able to stay at uni or not?
And do a lot of students feel like they have to have a gap year or something in between finishing school and studying to be eligible for some support because they can't do it any other way?
Oh, yeah. Like, one of the conditions to be for us to get youth allowance is you can work part-time and get, I think it's 75% of the national training wage in 14 months. But the catch with that is it can't be during secondary school. So for you to be eligible under those conditions, you essentially have to take a gap year. And it's like talking to students like from the city who take gap years going to Europe or whatever. But whenever like my sister took a gap year, that was so she could work and so she could get youth allowance. For us, it's generally so you can work to be able to support yourself in uni. And it's like coming from my hometown, I know a lot of kids took gap years and stuff for that and deferred their offers.
Yeah, I was going to ask, have you or your friends been impacted by this welfare support youth allowance issue?
Yeah, so it's like I can't get youth allowance because my parents earn too much. And like, I don't want to say that I'm not well off or anything, but it's like my mum's a nurse, my dad's a courier. Like, we're not earning crazy amounts. I was talking to one of my friends like last year and she was getting youth allowance for the first half of the year, but then because of the new financial year, she didn't get it. And that's because her dad sells cow lick for cattle. And because they got more sales that year, that means that she wasn't eligible. If you can't get youth allowance, generally you have to fall back on your parents, which does create a big financial burden. And it's like you don't like taking your parents' money, but it does become a bit of a burden of being able to pay them back, and you don't want to take their money because a lot of the time they don't have that disposable income. It's a big ask for them to be able to support you as well.
Can you explain how hard it is relocating from rural, remote area to go to university?
Yeah, it's huge. Like in your first year, you can get the tertiary access payment. I think you can get like $3,000 to $5,000 to help you with that relocation cost. But also, I remember I applied for that the second it opened, and I think I got that in April or May or something. Like this year, I've dropped down to three subjects instead of four. And I think there is a lot of stress because at uni and at the ANU, we're told that a full course load is essentially a full-time job, which is huge. And when you're trying to support yourself, it's hard to balance studying and work and also being able to find a job so you can support yourself in Canberra. And especially where like the cost of living is fairly high here, it's massive.
So you've dropped down subjects so you can work more and survive, basically.
Yeah, absolutely.
What do you think needs to happen to get more country students into uni, more young people from regional, remote, rural areas? Because that's definitely something the government says it's trying to do. We spoke to the Education Minister on Hack recently, said that's a huge priority. What do you think needs to happen?
I think there definitely needs to be change in terms of the government, and like changes to youth allowance and stuff would be great. But also I think in terms of unis as institution, I think there needs to be change. Like I only learnt about the ANU RRRS Society at the end of my first year. I know that some of my friends here didn't know about the tertiary access payment. Looking at the scholarships that are available to us, a lot of them are tailored towards specific disciplines and everything. And I looked at, there is one scholarship that is general for regional remote students, but I found out that that was funded by us. That was a group of students a few years ago started it up, and we're looking for stakeholders and everything. And so I think the way that we have to essentially fund our own scholarships, I don't think it's good enough. And I think there needs to be more support.
Yeah. Well, the good thing is the networks that build up, like the Regional Rural Remote Students Association, which you're part of at ANU. Isabella Coombs, thanks so much for having a chat with us on Hack. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Dave.
Hack on Triple J.
And you've got heaps to say on this. Someone says, I had no financial assistance from my parents whatsoever and lived on campus, but apparently that's not independent enough for Centrelink. Someone else says, it's a ridiculous system. I spent 2 years working on cattle stations saving money, had to pull every single paycheck to show to Centrelink, and it made me feel like it wasn't even worth it. Another person, youth allowance is crazy. My dad earns too much, yet he doesn't support me and doesn't even live in the same state. And someone else said, I moved to Sydney from the Riverina for university and I had to hold down 3 jobs to make rent after uni and job placement. Some pretty wild stories across the board there. Hey, that is all we've got time for on the Hack Podcast for now. I'll catch you tomorrow. See ya. Hack.